From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On today's show, why young Asian Americans find it hard to take on leadership roles. The Maori people of New Zealand turn to preschool to preserve their culture. And want to learn Chinese? You can now take lessons on the go.
For example, I had to drive from Chicago to Omaha, and I had some time, so I just, on my cell phone in the car, dialed up, had a good two-hour lesson.
Pacific Time, your passport to Asia and America. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. It was a week of physical and political upheavals in Asia. Several strong earthquakes shook Indonesia, killing at least 10 people. And politics in the Philippines was shaken by the life sentence handed down to former President Joseph Estrada for corruption. Prosecutors say he amassed $81 billion in bribes and illegal proceeds while he was president. Meanwhile, Japan's political scene was jolted by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's abrupt resignation. His last few days in office were tense for Abe. He was hospitalized for stress and exhaustion after the announcement. The aftershocks of his resignation sent his political party scrambling for a successor, while the Nikkei Index took a tumble. From Tokyo, Lucy Kraft has more.
When Shinzo Abe started his term exactly 1 year ago, he was on top of the world. The youngest Japanese prime minister in history, he was a protege of the wildly popular Junichiro Koizumi, who led Japan for 5 years. But Abe's initial 70% support seemed to vanish faster than the cherry blossoms in spring. After a series of corruption scandals and revelations that the government had bungled pension records for tens of millions of citizens, his approval rating was cut in half. In July, Abe's ruling party lost its majority in the upper house of parliament. But the party still controls the more powerful lower house, and Abe refused to quit. At last week's APEC meeting in Australia, he vowed to stake his political career on winning an extension for Japan's support of the anti-terror operations in Afghanistan. Right now, the Japanese Navy participates by refueling coalition warships in the Indian Ocean. But the Navy's authorization expires this fall, and Japan's resurgent opposition Democrats have threatened to block an extension. Robert Feldman is an economist with Morgan Stanley in Tokyo.
I think there was a genuine worry that as long as he's there, the Democrats aren't going to do anything, and he wants to get the bill through. So rather than certain trouble if he stays around, at least there's a chance that things might go better under somebody else. I doubt it, but it's possible.
Abe's sudden announcement left the leadership of the ruling party in disarray. They'll hold an internal election to replace Abe next week. One frontrunner is Taro Aso, who's conservative like Abe and has a habit of making controversial or insensitive remarks. Take his recent statement that even an Alzheimer's patient could tell that Japanese rice is more expensive than Chinese. Another candidate is Yasuo Fukuda, the son of a former prime minister. He's considered moderate, cool, and reserved, a temperament virtually the opposite of Aso's. Fukuda is an advocate of stronger regional integration in Asia and better relations with Japan's neighbors. But analyst Robert Feldman says whoever takes the reins next, Japan is probably headed backward as far as political and economic reform.
What matters is not who the prime minister is, but where policies go. And even before Abe's resignation today, it was very clear that the LDP was going back toward more fiscal spending to try to buy the next lower house elections. We're not going to have more structural reform. We are going to have larger fiscal deficits. So that's bad for stocks. It's bad for bonds.
The new head of the ruling party, who automatically gains the prime minister's title, could be decided by the end of next week. For Pacific Time, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
The world, we've all heard, is getting flatter thanks to the global economy and the internet. Cultures are blending like never before. More people are learning English as the international language of business. And now, many Americans are learning Chinese and other languages they once thought were too difficult. Until recently, many relied on prepackaged lessons on audio tape or expensive programs in the classroom. Now, as Vanessa Hua reports, the technology that's changed the world is also changing the way people learn new languages.
Dwight Branvold's taking time out from his busy life as a Silicon Valley tech manager. It's time for his Mandarin lesson. But he's not going to a classroom. Branvold's in his office in Northern California, and his teacher, Zhang Peng, is nearly 7,000 miles away in Guangzhou, southern China. 2 or 3 times a week, Branvold dials his tutor from his office when he's commuting, traveling, or even on vacation.
小张,下个星期日,市立剧院有一个北京京剧院演出。小张,这个星期日,市立剧院有一个北京的京剧院。
Yeah, great. You've done extra.
A few years ago, I started going to China pretty regularly to teach courses for my company. Not that I would teach the class in Chinese, I always teach in English. But at lunchtime and in the evening, in social situations, it would be very helpful if I could at least understand the culture, speak, you know, conversational Chinese.
Branvold used to go to a local tutor, but at $45 an hour, it was expensive and hard for him to fit in his schedule. He searched online and found Zhang, who runs a website called chinasimple.com. She charges only $10 an hour, and Branvold says the easy scheduling makes up for the lack of face-to-face interaction.
For my schedule, which I need flexibility, I travel, so I need someone that's available no matter where I am in the world. It's very amazing that I can be just driving along in my car anywhere, you know, Arkansas, Omaha. And, for example, I had to drive from Chicago to Omaha, and I had some time. So I just, on my cell phone in the car, dialed up, had a good 2-hour lesson.
Online tutoring began in the late 1990s, but it's grown in the past 5 years as communication technology becomes cheaper and easier to access. Software like the internet phone program Skype and chat programs like MSN and Yahoo Messenger make it easy to speak or chat to people anywhere in the world. It makes it possible for Branvold's teacher, Zhang Peng, to work from home. Most of her clients are foreigners doing business in China. She says she has the advantage of being a native speaker. And more importantly, she can also share information about daily life and Chinese culture.
In my opinion is that no one can study one language well until they can understand the background, the cultural background.
iTalkI.com is a new website based in Shanghai, which matches people who want to learn each other's language. Someone in China who wants to learn French can pair up with someone in France who's learning Mandarin. Its founder, Kevin Chen, is a Chinese-American who came to China 3 years ago to study the language.
You know, it was really interesting. You learn whatever, you know, you see how the Chinese teach languages, and then you see what really helps you. You know, does it help to sit in a class for 8 hours a day, you know, going through a textbook? You know, does it help to actually listen to these CDs that are really old and, you know, or these tapes that are really horribly outdated? Does it help to watch TV? Does it help to actually sit around and talk with Chinese people? And I think, you know, all those things are helpful, right? But the one that really kind of, you know, helped me along was, you know, being on the street, being, you know, talking with, you know, with your Chinese friends and forcing yourself to go through language exchanges.
Now, Chen says, he sees language exchange as diplomacy at the grassroots level.
I mean, you learn a lot, not just the language. I mean, you learn a lot about the culture as well. I mean, you can sit there and say, you know, hey, this trade with China, look at all these problems that's going on. I mean, did you ever think to ask a Chinese person? You know, it's kind of like, they're there. They got plenty of opinions.
Of course, the quality of the instruction that you get from a volunteer language exchange isn't likely to match a university-level course or private lessons from a trained tutor. But especially for Americans, who are infamous for their linguistic inabilities, any kind of language learning is a good place to start. For Pacific Time, I'm Vanessa Hua.
While millions of people study the big languages, English and Chinese, globalization is threatening the existence of some cultures and their native tongues. In New Zealand, there's a crusade to preserve sounds like this. This is the language of the Maori people. They responded to colonization by creating special preschools. The schools have been bringing together grandparents and babies to preserve language and tradition for 25 years. Lisa Morehouse reports from New Zealand.
When I enter this kohanga reo, or language nest, in the small town of Opotiki in New Zealand's eastern Bay of Plenty, the lead teacher greets me with a hug and immediately begins my education in the Maori language.
Tēnā koe, my name is Bobby Turetahi. I'm the kaiako of this institution.
Turetahi also wastes no time in teaching me a cultural lesson. Kohangareos are special places, treated like the sacred Maori meeting houses called marais.
We're going into what the learning area of the Kohangareo, and because we adhere to our tikanga Maori, the first thing we do is we remove our shoes at the door before we enter. We treat our learning area here as our marae. Mm. Shall we go in?
Morena kia koutou moko pūna mā. Kei te pēhea koe I te reata.
The classroom walls of the Te Whare Aroha Te Humare Kohangareo are decorated with bright posters of colors, native plants and animals, and the alphabet, all written in Maori. There are almost as many adults as preschool-aged children sitting in a circle on the rug during the morning mehi mehi, or greeting. The young students, like Kimberly, do a round-robin roll call.
Kia kaitai katoa.
Tēnā koe, Sandrali.
And not a word of English is spoken. Everything in a kohangareo is taught in te reo, the Maori language.
The language here is te reo Maori. It's total immersion. This is why kohangareo was started, was to maintain our reo. Our reo was dying.
By the 1850s, British settlers were the dominant political force in New Zealand. Much land was taken from the Maori, and even though missionary schools were open to teach Maori children, all instruction had to be in English. Bill Maxwell attended such native schools, starting in the 1930s.
It's supposed to have been geared towards upgrading Maori people to learn English language. As a consequence of that, Maori was barred from being spoken. Not only in school, but on the school grounds as well.
Students were even beaten for speaking Maori. And by 1960, only a quarter of Indigenous people called Maori their first language. Sharon Campbell, now a principal at a nearby immersion primary school, remembers how language loss happened, even in the heavily Maori region of the North Island's east coast.
The majority of parents, although they had fluency in te reo, they did not speak any Māori to their children, only amongst their own generation. You heard it around you, but it was not directed at you. And as a result, the majority of my generation have no understanding of te reo Māori.
In the late 1970s, Māori elders held huis, tribal meetings at which they developed solutions to this staggering loss. A grassroots Kohangareo movement began, and 100 such schools were in place by
1982.
The first teachers brought a knowledge of the language and of the culture.
Some of them were grandparents, some were elders. A lot of them were people conversant in all matters pertaining to Māori. So they had actually a very deep knowledge, not only of the language, but the customs and prayers. Because a lot of our teaching is based on spiritual things and our environment. Māori people are very spiritual.
And in this morning's class, I was asked to turn off my recorder just once, during the class prayers to Maori gods and ancestors. About 500 language nests exist around New Zealand today, serving more than 10,000 students. An estimated 60,000 children have graduated from Kohangareos since 1982. There's much need to ensure the Maori are educated well. The latest census indicated only about half of Maori adults were employed, and they have the poorest health in all of New Zealand. In traditional schools, Maori students are overrepresented in truancy, suspension, and dropout rates.
We are in a state of crisis, absolutely. The first funeral we had here at our local marae this year in January was a suicide. Many of our families live the statistics that statisticians write. Many of them. Many of our children have to live that legacy.
Campbell believes in Māori immersion education, in part from seeing her own children succeed. Each of her 7 children has attended Kohangareo's, an immersion or bilingual programs in primary and secondary school.
My children can walk both worlds. They can go to their marae. They know every word that's spoken in Māori, and they know the practices and what's expected of them there. And they can also do that in the European institutions.
These experiences bear out in statistics. Students who attend immersion schools achieve at higher rates than Maori and mainstream schools. But perhaps the best evidence comes from individual examples, like the exchange Daphne Maxwell saw between a child and his koro, his grandfather, which inspired her participation in Kohangareo's.
When you see a child walking down the road holding their koro's hand, talking Māori, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful sight.
For Pacific Time, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Opotiki, New Zealand.
There are 13 million Asian Americans in the United States. That's 4% of the population. But when it comes to politics, only 8 members of Congress, less than 2%, are of Asian heritage. Activists in the community say the same kind of disparity is found in business, entertainment, and other sectors. And they want to change that. Hundreds of Asian Americans recently gathered in San Francisco for a leadership conference that attracted the young and hip. Organizers hope the conference, which is called Inspire, will train the next generation of community leaders. Pacific Times' Mina Kim checked it out.
Inspire is modeled after similar leadership conferences held a decade or so ago called Aspire. Organizer Brian Wang says it reflects an attempt to reach out to people who may need inspiration because they're not thinking of themselves as leaders.
One of the major goals of our conference is to bring in the young people who might not be as aware of Asian Pacific American issues. And like we found that at a lot of these community events, it's always the same people, the same intrinsically aware, conscious individuals who keep attending those events. And we were wondering, how do we reach out to those other peers, those other members of our generation who are just out there partying and watching TV and not really doing anything to give back to the community?
Still, the overall tone was serious. One session examined stereotypical images of Asian Americans in the entertainment industry. Another described the so-called bamboo ceiling, preventing Asian Americans from reaching executive-level jobs. Most of the 250 participants were born in the U.S. or came here as children. They're often struggling with contradictions between the values they learned at home and what's expected of Americans in leadership roles, like these workshop participants.
My parents often told me growing up, like, you know, don't go into politics. You know, politics is too messy. Just focus on something that you can control, where people know whether you're good or bad. And if you're good, then you'll succeed. And if you're bad, then you won't.
Asian American women especially, like, are held back, especially by their families, because my family, like, my parents always kind of try to hold me back. It's like, okay, you know, you need to be quiet and you need to just, like, go with the flow and things like that.
But this attendee got the encouragement she needed from a panel of Asian American women trailblazers. Others learned to create assertive images of themselves in a session called Building Your Personal Brand. There were also sessions with successful Asian American entrepreneurs, activists, and politicians, like California State Controller John Chiang. Mentorship was a major theme at Inspire 07, says conference organizer Brian Wang. In fact, it's the reason he called it Inspire in the first place.
The word inspire, you know, it's more of a term that comes after you've done something great and you wish to encourage others below you or coming up behind you to do great things as well. We want to ensure that our predecessors pass on their lessons to the next generation.
For Wang, who took time off work and contributed significant personal finances in order to pull off the conference, he's hoping a few people got inspired to organize it with him next year. For Pacific Time, I'm Mina Kim in San Francisco.
What would you do if you could travel back in time? Hang out with medieval kings? Take on the dinosaurs? How about a stroll through old world Europe? The artist Hiroshi Sugimoto is way ahead of you. He's done all that and more using an unlikely time machine, his camera. It earned him a big following around the world, including his native Japan and in the U.S. where he lives. Allison Bing spoke to Sugimoto.
I decided to make my art heavily related to the concept of the time.
For Hiroshi Sugimoto, that medium is photography.
So let's use the system of camera as a tool to trace back, actually time traveling back to our ancient time, our culture, our history.
In his current show at San Francisco's De Young Museum and one coming up at the nearby Asian Art Museum, Sugimoto has included photographs of 17th century Holland, Imperial Japan, New York before the Twin Towers fell. Historical details are accurate. The lighting seems natural. And no, there's no Photoshop manipulation. Yet Sugimoto's images are convincing, and he's managed to go back a couple million years for his shot of a Paleolithic hunting scene.
Right after I moved from Los Angeles to New York, and I went to see the Natural History Museum in New York, and I saw this fascinating scene with painted backdrops with hyena eating dead zebra, after being killed by a lion.
Of all the dioramas to choose in the museum, why photograph such a sinister one? Sugimoto says there was something familiar about this feeding frenzy.
This is like a typical New York scenes. You know, this is a capitalism. So I feel like I'm being a dead zebra being eaten by so many art investors, art collectors, art dealers, and then even the museums.
Sugimoto also photographed King Henry VIII. Well, not really. He went to wax museums late at night and created his photos, seeing more than lifeless figures.
Of course, it's fake and it's everything's dead. But by some reason, I was able to just put the life into it. It's that the people tend to believe it. It's a live person. So if you tend to believe that this is live, then you have to question what is life and what is death.
Many people would get the creeps visiting wax museums after hours or hiking treacherous coastal cliffs before dawn, as Sugimoto does, to capture his shimmering, timeless seascapes.
I like a creepy spot, actually. For example, for the seascape shooting, I'm trying to recreate ancient people's vision. The landscape, the humans, we changed it. We destroyed it sometimes. So to get this rebel, I have to be away from the civilization. So I go to a very remote places, no one around me, just by myself, 100 miles away. There's no human presence. Transfer my mind to the ancient state of the mind. Then I feel like I'm shooting, using camera in ancient time is very strange, but I feel like I'm riding in a time machine and approaching to the way past.
Sugimoto's seascapes glow like light boxes, but they capture scenes that came before electricity, before beach vacations, before humankind even. His most famous manipulations of time are taken in movie theaters, where he exposed a single shot through the entire running time of a film. The end result is a cinema screen with a kind of holy halo, casting an otherworldly light across empty theater seats. In some of Sugimoto's skyline photographs, long exposure times make entire city skyscrapers seem to disappear into thin air. Only strong shapes survive what Sugimoto describes as his attack on modern architecture. In one shot taken in 1997, most buildings on the New York skyline appear to dissolve into an East River mist. Only the World Trade Center's towers stand tall.
Architectural historians, the people never praised so much on the Twin Towers, but I liked it. I thought it's fascinating, so I decided to keep a record of it. And then it survived my attack, but it c- didn't survive from the 9/11 attack. So that it's remained as my history. I'm lucky that I have this image in this show.
The post-9/11 world has affected Hiroshi Sugimoto's work in another way. He says it's no longer possible for him to fly with a special film for his large format camera, since security X-rays ruin the kind of exposures he does. For Pacific Time, I'm Allison Bing.
It's time for us to say goodbye. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you heard here? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Nguyen Quyduc, Sil Muller, Susie Racho, Lita Martinez, Helen Lee, Pei Wong, Michelle Lee, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.